Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Gail Seiler, one of your hosts for today, together with Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula, and hello to you, the listener.
Hello. Today we are going to begin with the language of coyotes. But before we get into that, some precipitation is expected for today and tomorrow, so we wanted to mention that. Scattered flurries are predicted for today between noon and 2 p.m., and tonight there will be a chance of snow and sleet. Today we are talking about coyotes, and this is part of our attention to phenology, the tracking of natural events of plants and animals in relation to the yearly calendar. Pat Schlarbaum, KHOI's environmental reporter, is here with us, and welcome, Pat. Welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome.
It's always good to have you. It's always good to have you stop by. So why don't you explain, why are we listening to coyotes at this time?
It's just initiating their breeding season. So this is the time of the coyotes on these sun or moonlit evenings.
So if one is out in the country, one might hear the coyotes.
Absolutely.
And that's why, because...
Well, yeah, they're essentially the males are putting up a howl to attract their mates. And there are last year's coyotes that are with the females. So when one gets going, it seems like it creates quite a convention.
You know, one of the nice things about this is that, like a number of other animal species, they're feeling spring before we're seeing it.
Innate behavior kicks in. Yeah, absolutely.
So they know that spring is coming, even though...
It must be the lengthening of the days. I think the photo period, as much as anything, people are starting to realize they can get home from work and have something to do, and then the coyotes are soon to follow.
That's right. And when we get up for Local Talk, it's light out.
Yes, that was quite a change. I'm noticing that.
Yeah.
So, Pat... tell us about the vocalizations. We heard a number of sounds when we started the show. How many different languages do coyotes speak?
There are essentially 11 different vocalizations, and it was William Clark with the Lewis and Clark fame that kind of noticed coyotes for the first time in their exploration in 1804, and they called them the barking dogs. And they were familiar with the eastern wolves, but this was a different critter. This was a dog, a canine in the ground, and that was relatively new to science.
So you brought some sounds with you?
Yeah.
Let's listen to a few before we go on.
Back in the 60s, our neighbor, Tisha Moeller, she was from Arkansas, and she was somewhat familiar with the coyote calls, and she would call that quite a convention of coyotes. And there was a misunderstanding that people presumed that the Conservation Commission at that time had brought the coyotes from the western states, and it simply was not the case. However, there are, and Tisha's in her 90s now, and she still brings up the coyotes and how the DNR brought them in.
So how likely is one to see a coyote or encounter one?
Actually, they're pretty shy and elusive of human beings, but they have evolved to fulfill a niche, particularly around our urban areas. Now, there's another canine, the foxes, that they've kind of usurped the open prairie territory, and the foxes are definitely around our urban areas. But more and more, especially the larger cities, are suited for a coyote niche. And by that, we're the Garden of Eden, essentially, when it comes to having prey of possums and rabbits and the mice. And that's essentially their prey base.
I think you once mentioned that the foxes are coming into town more because they're trying to get away from the coyotes.
That's kind of what's evolved in that regard. They're they're going to fulfill a niche.
So that raises the question, how dangerous are coyotes? Who do they attack and when do they attack?
Well, any mother would protect her young. I don't want to put the threat out there. It's really nature in all its manifestations. But, you know, you never say never. There's probably more dog attacks than coyote attacks. And by that I mean just injury, inadvertent injuries.
So who do coyotes attack?
Well, they're here after small prey.
Let's say it differently. What is the prey for coyotes?
Yeah, that would be the mice and rabbits. They're small mammals. And over eons, that's what they look for.
But they have been known to attack dogs, right?
Sure. Yeah, you never see a fat coyote. They're always just as many of them that can fulfill that niche on the landscape, and so they're always kind of borderline. They're usually hustling something to eat. So with that, yeah, you want to kind of be cognizant of that. But they're loud noises, hoses. You know, they're smart to get away.
Would a coyote attack a person?
I'm not aware of any coyote attacks. Even, you know, there is the other canine, the wolf, that people have a fear of also. And I might just mention there is a new species that is kind of becoming urbanized in eastern locales, particularly, well, New York City and Chicago and Detroit. There was a niche, and there were fewer and fewer wolves as they were essentially exterminated. And some of the coyotes got together, and they call them coy wolves or eastern coyotes. Now, this animal is somewhat of a hybrid. It's between a coyote would be around 40 pounds, a wolf double that. These coy wolves are essentially in between. And they are fulfilling this niche. They like our urban areas with our Canada geese, of all things. They can really prey on the eggs and the young of the Canada geese.
So is this literally a combination between a wolf and a coyote?
Yeah, historically, it's one of the few species that you can look clear back to its origin in the Algonquin Provincial Park near Ontario in Canada. And in the 1920s, this species was becoming established. And it was essentially because the wolves were wiped out. Mm-hmm. And these coy wolves, it's kind of fascinating that you would know the origin and the date of where this unique individual originated. So they are an in-between, and they're working our the prey base. But
so, Pat, before we go out, you did mention to me before this interview that there are a few wolves been sighted in Iowa. Can you just give us a brief sense of what the situation is with wolves?
Exactly. And we were anticipating some wolf activity with the rogue males coming through northeastern Iowa. There's packs at Black River Falls in Wisconsin. And lo and behold, last year there was a large canine that was shot. They were unprotected in Iowa, and it weighed 77 pounds. And you get to look at this animal and say, that's a wolf. That's bigger than a coyote. And that was in Buchanan County. And then also, then there was a second in Jones. And here just a few weeks ago, there was another canine taken in Franklin County. And the irony of this phenomena, essentially, these animals coming through, they're young females. So has been no documentation of any breeding yet. But it's just something for the listeners to kind of keep in mind that in Iowa, we have such a concentrated prey base, if you will, next to our rivers. You know, we think that we're all just corn and beans and flat. Mm-hmm. But where there is wildlife, there's a lot of wildlife. And they seem to be attracted to that. And the coy wolves that were probably more of a coy wolf than a regular wolf, they like our deer. And they have the jowls and the jaws to work on the deer, whereas a coyote does not. So it's really kind of fascinating. It's something new. It's something for the listeners to look forward to in their travels. Try not to be fearful, but just experience something that's pretty rich and rare in the environment.
Well, Pat, it's been good, as always, to have you stop by and bring a piece of the wilderness with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's a great way to start the show, and thank you. Yeah. And come by again soon.
Thank you.
We're going to give you a coyote soundtrack to take your leave by.
Okay.
Thanks, Pat.
Okay. Thank you.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI, and yes, those were coyotes. Your ears were not deceiving you. For the remainder of the show, we're going to be looking at two issues that are being considered by the Iowa State Legislature. The first has to do with high school attendance. Most people recognize that a high school diploma is the gateway to a life of options for a young person. However, according to the U.S. Department of Education, the 2013 national high school graduation rate was 81%. That sounds like good news, but it also means that nationwide, almost 20% of our young people don't graduate. That's 2 out of 10. In fact, more than 1 million students in the United States drop out of high school each year. The graduation rate in Iowa is better than the national average. In Iowa, the dropout rate is approximately 1 in 10, according to the Iowa Department of Education. And here in Ames, the graduation rate at Ames High School is about 92%. However, according to data on the Iowa Department of Education website, the graduation rate for African American students at Ames High School is only 52%. Senator Herman Kornbach, a Democrat from Ames and chairman of the Iowa Senate Education Committee, is sponsoring legislation that addresses high school attendance. Senate Study Bill 1138 would raise the compulsory school age to 18. Iowa law now requires students to attend school from age 6 and until age 16. So if Bill 1138 passes, Iowa students wouldn't be able to leave school until they were 18 years old. I spoke with the senator after the League of Women Voters legislative wake-up, an event that took place last Saturday in Ames. He referred to West Virginia, which raised the mandatory school attendance age from 16 to 17 about 5 years ago and has seen positive impacts. Senator Kornbach said he believes that opportunities for success are very limited for a 16-year-old high school dropout. In an interview with the Des Moines Register, he described the new law, or the potential new law, as one tool that is useful to help persuade students and their families to keep at it until they can get their high school diploma. We wanted to get the perspective of a local high school professional. So last week, I spoke about the proposed legislation with Jonas Michaels, who is the director of alternative learning programs for the Ames Community School District. I began our conversation by asking Jonas what that department does.
In our district, we have and we obviously like to speak in acronyms, but we call it the ALP department, Alternative Learning Program. And so for ALP, I oversee our dropout prevention programs, our at-risk programs, our homelessness programs, Title I, ESL, which is English as a second language, and our school counselors in our district. Our largest funding stream is our dropout prevention and at-risk funds.
So what we want to talk mainly about today are the dropout prevention and intervention programs. Can you describe some of those, specifically what's in place?
We have a collection of programs and options for students starting as young as kindergarten and, of course, going all the way through 12th grade. Our district is unique in that we use our funds to also fund our prevention programs. And so we know that one of the highest predictors for dropout or students who are not going to graduate is not being able to read by the end of third grade level, being on grade level reading by the end of third grade. And so we actually have what's called the Success Program at the elementary program. And the focus there is to really work with students who we call struggling readers, students who are having some difficulties with reading, and trying to help assist them to become proficient in reading before the end of their third grade year. Obviously, sometimes the work is not done right at third grade, and so we provide that support throughout the entire elementary program. We also have at-risk counselors at every single building. So that would be certified school counselors who are working with students who exhibit some signs of at-riskness, and those can be attendance issues, issues with behaviors, issues with performing well in courses, kind of what we call the ABCs of dropout prevention, attendance, behavior, and course completion. And so they identify students who might show some or at-risk factors in at least two of those categories and develop a relationship with students and hopefully come together and set some goals and hopefully accomplish those goals before those kids leave the elementary level. And very similar programs at the middle school. At the middle school, instead of success, they call them ALP teachers. And again, we have counselors there at the middle school level as well. And then at the middle school level, the support is in both math and literacy. And then at the high school, we have ALP teachers, but it's in the area of math, English. We have social studies. Believe it or not, we also have PE. So those are courses that we find that students, we have a higher failure rate in those courses, so we want to provide more supports in those areas. And again, we also have a dedicated at-risk counselor at the high school level.
And are there other programs, or is that mainly the programs that you have in place to prevent dropout?
Well, no, there are other programs. At the high school, we have a lot more options, obviously, because at that point, sometimes we find that students are not going to be as successful maybe in the high school setting. And so we have some programs that are off campus, such as night school. We have something that we call Net High, where students are working remotely from off-site to receive their credits. And then we also have another program where we partner with a community college called Gateway to College, where they're trying to simultaneously earn high school credits and college credits at the same time.
What is the dropout rate at Ames High School?
Dropout rate hovers around 2% for Ames High School. We have significantly decreased the number of dropouts last school year compared to the previous 3 years. Officially, what we have is for the 2012-13 school year, so that would be about 2 years ago, the dropout rate itself was 2.92%. So that was a total of 38 students dropped out during that school year. In the year before that, it was 3.03%, which is 41 students. And then the year before that, during the 2010-11 school year, it was 3.17%, which is 44 students. And last year, again, we've been really working hard at this. Last year, we had only 15 dropouts. That's huge for us. I mean, a district our size, we're really proud of that number.
Is there a difference between the way graduation rates are reported and dropout rates? The reason I ask that is because I was looking on the State Department of Education website, and you can look up what they have is what's called graduation rate.
Yep.
And
different.
So maybe you could explain that a little bit.
The simplest term that I can use is that the dropout rate is all students in grades 7 through 12 that have dropped out that year. So let's use last year's number. We had 15 kids. That could have been an 8th grader, a 9th grader, 4 10th graders, and the rest can be juniors and seniors. So that's every year, grades 7 through 12. That's what that number represents. So you take the population from your total student population from grades 7 through 12 in that school year, and that's how you get the rate. It's a cohort data. Students who entered as 9th graders, and it tracks those students all the way through their senior year. So if, for example, we had, remember, a 10th grader who dropped out, their number or their dropout actually won't count into the graduation rate until their class should have graduated. And so that's why the numbers look, or the percentages look different. So when I look at the 2012-13 school year, our dropout rate was 2.92%, but our graduation rate was 90.97%.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Thanks for explaining that. In your work with youth, what would you say are the reasons? I know it's hard to generalize, but what are some of the reasons for students choosing to drop out of school? Or maybe they don't choose. Maybe it just kind of happens.
You know, one of the things that I share with my staff and staff across the district is that it's not a sudden decision. No student wakes up their 10th grade year or their junior year or senior year in high school and say, you know what, today's the day that I'm going to drop out from school. What I believe and what research will show is that it's a gradual disengagement from our K-12 system. So students have, and we have good data to help us identify those students who might potential dropouts as young as 6th grade. We do collect that data and analyze it every 3 weeks and try to put supports in place for those students. But it's a gradual disengagement. Kids have lost engagement at some point throughout their educational career. and it just continues to build up and build up. And at some point, too, you know, when they're a junior or a sophomore, and we see most of our dropouts either their junior or senior year, they come to the realization that I'm at this age and I'm this far into high school and I only have this many credits. And so sometimes kids make the decision at that point and say, what's the purpose? You know, here I am a junior with only 10 credits. Some students will say, well, yeah, though I might have 10 or 15 credits, I do want to come to school next year. I know I won't graduate, but I will finish out my 4 years and then drop out at the end of the fourth year. There's many reasons. There's economic reasons. Some students might decide that they need to work and support themselves or support their families. The reasons varies by the students. But one thing I do know is that after the decision is made, almost all of them regret it. And that when you allow someone as young as 16 years old to be able to make that decision of being able to drop out, that's too young to make an adult decision like that. But almost all of them regret it.
Since you mentioned the age, that brings us to the question about the bill that's recently been introduced, SSB 1138, which would raise the compulsory school age to 18. I know there's no easy solution to the complex picture that you painted and the complex issues around students dropping out of school, but maybe you could just talk about some thoughts about that law if you think it would help in some way.
Here's one thing it will do. What it would help with is our dropout rate. So no longer can we have students who can make that decision to drop out at 16 or 17 years old. They would have to wait until they're 18. So it would assist us in that manner. But it doesn't necessarily assist us in ensuring that they are going to graduate. We have kids at the moment who might be 15 years old and are not doing much in school and are not motivated to do well for whatever reasons. And so they're just waiting for that compulsory age to reach so that they can drop out of school. So with that being said, it does help with eliminating the ability for kids making that important decision at such a young age. On the flip side, sometimes kids who have made the decision not to graduate or to stay in school, they do so because of their family situations. And I don't know if this will cause additional burden or stress in their personal lives. Whatever reasons that kids make that decision, they make it sometimes with their family in mind, or sometimes for just not a mature reason. And so I think it helps make kids wait until they're older to make that decision. Good in that way.
So that may be a plus of it, whether it really enables them to stay in school and continue learning and therefore successfully graduate, that would be another question.
Yeah, and I've read some reports that states that have raised the compulsory mm-hmm. age, one of the things that they see is that 25% of those students who would have been potential dropouts actually do graduate. So they do, in some ways, increase their graduation rate. There's still about 75% of those students who don't graduate. I think it's one strategy. I think you have to think about multiple strategies when you're looking at ensuring kids stay in school and, more importantly, graduate from high school.
Once someone drops out or stops coming to school, what are their options for getting a high school diploma? Can they return to school if they're under 18? What about if they're over 18? Or what other programs are there that can help them get their diploma?
The only way to get a diploma is through a high school. Now, there are diploma equivalencies out there, too. But in terms of those kids who made that decision to drop out, I should have been more specific in the name of our program. It's not just dropout prevention. It's actually called dropout/dropout prevention. So that first part, which is dropout, it's our obligation to actually go out there and recover those students who have dropped out from school. So that's the first step, is recover them, but then re-engage them into the curriculum. And sometimes it has to be something totally different than the experience that caused them to leave in the first place. Sometimes the traditional class setting doesn't work for those students. So we actively try to go out there and seek those students out. We actually have students who might have dropped out 3 or 4 times throughout their high school career, and every year we go through that same song and dance and going out there and finding them and recovering them and re-engaging them into the school setting to hopefully get them across that stage. If a student decides that, you know, going into the high school setting is not going to work for me, we look at offering them different options, such as, like I said, our off-campus settings, our night school, credit recovery through some online programming that we have. And then some students say, still, this is not for me. In that case, then, you know, there are other options that are not necessarily a high school diploma, but a high school equivalency. And that would be the HiSET as an example. Some students decide to join Job Corps, and that's an option that we're seeing more and more students utilize, where they're going and getting job training and working towards their GED. And while they're doing that, they have a safe place to live and are earning some money.
And learning some other skills that may be useful to them in finding employment.
Absolutely. And then some kids just register at a local community college. They study for several weeks for this exam and receive a high school equivalency. So there are some options. And we've had some success stories of students who have dropped out of school. And again, with just some maturity and some time, a different place in their life, decided to go back and maybe pursue that GED option, get into a community college, and are now in four-year institutions.
Do you see a difference if you look at either dropout rates or graduation rates in terms of different demographic groups, maybe male and female or other different subsets within the population?
We do definitely track those trends, and we typically see, and I think this is probably would mirror the state as well. There are some subgroups that have lower graduation rates than other subgroups. For example, low SES or students who are on free and reduced lunch tend to see a lower graduation rate with them. We recognize that that's an issue, and we're trying to think of creative ways to address those populations. You know, some of our minority subgroups have lower graduation rates as well. Again, it's an issue that we're aware of and we're trying to address.
And does involvement in the juvenile justice system or other legal issues often connect with students who drop out?
What we know is that students who do drop out are 3.5 times more likely to be arrested in their lifetime. So I think that there's a very strong correlation there between students who do drop out and being involved in the juvenile system or legal system.
And you do work with the district court and the county attorney on some issues regarding students who don't go to school?
Sure. You know, and I think it goes back to your original question about whether or not raising the compulsory age is a good thing or a bad thing. I think regardless of what the age is, whether it's 16 or 18 or whether it's 17, if they want to compromise in the middle, the only way to enforce this when schools are having a difficult time getting kids to come to school and staying in school is through what's in Iowa code, and we're not able to enforce that when it gets to a certain level. We'll try our best. 2 years ago, we actually changed our own attendance policy so that it can better align to Iowa code, so that when we do get to a certain point where we're struggling with attendance, and it has to be pretty severe, we try to handle a lot of that issue, those issues in-house. We believe in working with families. We believe in trying to mediate the situation within the school setting. But sometimes we do get to a point where there might be kids that are missing 30-plus days of school, and it's not due to an illness. And so we need some support from our county attorney to intervene and hold the parents more accountable to getting those kids to school. We have tons and tons of families in our community that make sure that their kids get up in the morning, get ready for school, and are prepared and ready to learn when they enter our school building. So to those parents, thank you. And then there are some that we, you know, work very closely with, and we're working on, you know, building those relationships and helping those families understand the importance of attendance. Coming to school every day is very important. You know, the more that we can have students in our buildings, the more likely they're going to learn and become more and more proficient students. And then just recognizing as a whole that the consequences personally, socially, and economically of students who are dropping out from school have a ripple effect on our families, communities, and most definitely our nation at large. So this is not just a situation that only impacts that specific student and their family. It has great impacts on our community as well.
We want to thank Yannis Michaels for speaking with KHOI last week. He is the Director of Alternative Learning Programs for the Ames Community School District. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts today on Local Talk, here together with Gail Seiler. And we are looking today at high school and why students drop out. And as we heard, it's a complex issue, and there are many questions that remain.
And because of the many reasons why students leave school, some feel that a law such as SSB 1138 is not the answer. But supporters of the bill feel that it is at least a piece of the answer. Of course, such alternatives depend on whether state lawmakers provide additional money for students to participate in alternative education programs that may better meet their needs. So discussions around this legislation will continue going forward.
And again, this legislation would require young people to stay in school until 18 instead of the current rate, which is
16.
You can leave school at 16.
Right.
And this is being introduced by Senator Herman Kornbach.
Correct. Yes, he sponsored this legislation. During the break, we're going to hear the song that just won the Academy Award for Best Original Song. It is from the movie Selma.
When the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
Woman and child, even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles from dark roads, heroes to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. The biggest weapon is to stay peaceful. We sing, our music is the cuts that we bleed through. Somewhere in the dream we had an epiphany. Now we right the wrongs in history. No one can win a war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders.
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. The song you just heard was Glory by John Legend and Common. The song, which was from the movie Selma, recently won an Academy Award for Best Original Song.
And we've been joined here in the studio by the Honorable State Senator Steve Sodders. Senator Sodders recently sponsored several Senate bills to change the way possession of small amounts of marijuana is dealt with in our legal system. And we want to say a big thank you to the senator for being with us this morning, early this morning during this busy legislative session. And welcome to KHOI. I think this is your first time here.
First time here, and thanks for having me.
Okay. So let's get started. Can you explain the marijuana-related bills you introduced?
Sure. We've got several. One was taking low amounts of possession of marijuana, 5 grams or less, and moving that to a simple misdemeanor from a serious misdemeanor. We currently, any possession of marijuana, even if it's very, very small amounts, even as low as scrapings out of a pipe would be considered a serious misdemeanor, which is up to a year in jail and some pretty hefty fines. And then so we're moving smaller amounts, 5 grams or less, to a simple misdemeanor, which would be then just a ticketable offense to court. So that's one change that we are looking at. Now, if it's over 5 grams, obviously it would still be a serious misdemeanor, possession. And then the second bill we have is looking at possession with the intent to deliver small amounts of marijuana, moving that from a Class D felony to an aggravated misdemeanor. And so that would be the second bill we're working on currently, and we've had some really good meetings with both the Republicans and the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee on that bill. Finally, well, there's two other ones. There's the medical marijuana issue that we've been working on for several years, and Senator Bolcom has kind of taken the lead on that, but I've worked with him on his bill. And then with that, what the legislature did last year with the medical cannabis oil, one of the things that I felt we needed to do was change marijuana from a Schedule I controlled substance to a Schedule II. And really, for folks out there, what that means is Schedule I's are mean that the drug has or the substance has no medical value, and Schedule II says it has some. So your other drugs in Schedule II would be cocaine, methamphetamine, and those other things are sitting in Schedule II because the derivatives are used for medical purposes. Well, if we're going to use marijuana in the same way, it should be a Schedule II, not a Schedule I.
So, yeah, that makes sense. And just to be clear, would these bills legalize marijuana in any way? Our listeners might be wondering about that.
No. So in Iowa, we're not looking at recreational use or legalizing marijuana. But there are, in my view, as you look at the numbers, there are better ways to treat this. And for folks out there, I'm also a deputy sheriff. So I've been in law enforcement 26 years, worked undercover drugs for 3.5 years of that time. So I've worked with a lot of folks, both with marijuana and other drugs, cocaine, methamphetamine, all the rest of those. So as a legislator, I've been looking at, you know, how can we do things a little bit better, a little bit smarter, both in the criminal justice system, maybe looking at less people going to jail or prison. How do we save money that way? Minority impacts to some of our laws. And really, so the committee, or at least judiciary, I've been pushing them this year as chair to look at ways that we can have positive impacts on minority impact in prison, but also those low-risk offenders, low risk to violence, low risk to other things, how do we treat them differently than we do the folks who are high-risk, you know, people that assault people and all those. Those to me are high-risk, high-violent crimes that we should be stiffer on, and the lower stuff, the nonviolent stuff, we should maybe try to find a better way to do it. And it saves taxpayer money, too.
So, I kind of get the gist of what you're saying. Could you summarize why you think this would be better?
Well, at least when we looked at the 5 grams and less, we had corrections do a bunch of numbers for us of folks who have been picked up for small amounts of marijuana. And typically, those folks who were under 5 grams, the cost to the whole system and to that person is humongous, even though these are very low nonviolent crimes. So currently, in the current system, if I were to pick somebody up for small amounts of marijuana, I would arrest them. I would take them to jail. They would be there at least overnight until they saw a judge the next morning. Because it's a serious, the judge will not let them plead guilty like you can with a simple. And so now you have to get an attorney, and either a court-appointed attorney, which we all pay for, or they have to get their own attorney, which costs money. And then it might be 6 months, maybe 3 to 6 months before they get their court date to plead guilty. And typically the judges, or at least on a first offense, treat it like a simple anyway. There's usually a fine, maybe some community service, maybe a probation. Which is also, the local probation officers have to then track these folks. Every bit of that along the way costs money both to the system and to the person for relatively small amounts of for a nonviolent crime. So if you look at moving that to a simple, you cut out a lot of that cost. And that just seems like it's a better way to go for our system. And then those dollars we save, in my view, can go to keeping the more violent people in jail and prisons because we now have more bed space.
So what would be arguments against this if there are people who think that this isn't a good idea?
What are the downsides?
Yeah, the downsides.
So far, at least with the 5 grams and less, I would say it's more an optical thing for legislators, for elected officials. You know, am I going to look like I'm soft on crime? We don't decriminalize stuff.
So optical means how the public perceives you?
Correct, and depending on what area you have. My district is really a kind of a 50-50 district. I don't have, if you go to Johnson County, they love this idea. And because of Iowa City and I think just the way that those folks live in that area. So that's the challenge on any bill in Iowa is that we all have different pieces of Iowa. And western Iowa is different than eastern Iowa. So it's always that's the challenge on any of these.
And you are in law enforcement. You're a deputy sheriff for Marshall County,
yes.
Is it? Yes. And so how is this perceived by others in law enforcement in the state?
I have not had any issues with either the law enforcement lobby folks or the Sheriffs and Deputies Association. I've talked to the guys I work with, the local drug task force guys. I, in fact, had them come down to Des Moines to show the committee different amounts of marijuana, what it looks like, how it's packaged. And even those guys are like, yeah, this makes sense. It's, we're not decriminalizing it. It's just a smarter way to do it. And even when you look at the 42.5 gram bill I have, when you consider almost in every other law, we have stair-stepping amounts of penalty. Well, not in possession with the intent to deliver marijuana. We have, if I deliver a small amount of marijuana to you, half ounce, which is 14 grams or so, clear up to 100 pounds. That's all a Class D felony. And there's no stair-stepping in there. That's kind of ridiculous to me. And so we were looking at how do we put a step in. And the step looks like at 42.5 grams and below would be a good step to make that an aggravated. Smaller amounts. These are typically folks, if you have 42 or if you buy 40 grams, you're usually using some and you might be selling some so that you can buy some more for yourself. It's more of a you're not really making money. You're trying to buy more for yourself, as opposed to the person who's selling pounds of the stuff. They're trying to make money, and that's a little bit different. So we picked 42.5 gram for that reason. And also in Iowa law, if you have 42.5 grams of marijuana or above, you're supposed to have a tax stamp. In Iowa, there's a tax stamp law, and so that if you don't have a tax stamp, that's a Class D felony as well. So really, in both
what
of those,
what is a tax stamp?
A tax, essentially, if you're selling marijuana in Iowa, you're supposed to buy a tax stamp or any drug. Which, by the way, no one does
because you're supposed to be paying.
You're supposed to be paying taxes because you're selling it
when you sell it.
Okay.
but by the way, no one does it.
Well, yeah.
No one buys a tax stamp. No one's
obviously
sales
yeah.
tax are not coming in.
Right. We're speaking with this Honorable Senator, State Senator Steve Sodders. And Mr. Sodders recently proposed several Senate bills to change the way possession of small amounts of marijuana is dealt with by our legal system. Senator Sodder, have similar proposals been made in the past? And if so, what's different about introducing it this time?
I have been in since 2009, got elected in 2008, and nowhere, at least I can tell prior to that, or since I've been in, that anybody has proposed any of these type of changes. And again, some of it's just the optics of do we want to look like we're soft on crime and decriminalization and all those things. But I think it's specifically in the area of marijuana where you have other states who have looked at it in medical purposes, people are at least and I think the numbers are panning out through polling through Iowa is that people do look at this as a possible medical use. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's loosened some of the harshness that we've put on some of the, at least in the criminal code, on what we're looking at as marijuana.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, kind of in passing, the impact on minorities. And one aspect of this is a particular concern. According to a nationwide study done by the American Civil Liberties Union, a black person is 3.7 times as likely to be arrested for marijuana as a white person, despite similar marijuana usage rates. And according to the Civil Liberties Union, Iowa has the largest racial disparity in the country of arrests in marijuana possession. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, that was one of the things I looked at. When we currently we have about 3.3% black in Iowa as a minority group, and we have about 7% Latino Hispanic in Iowa. And then so if you look at the prison population, and it, specifically when I looked at it on marijuana and possession with the intent, what you see is this huge disparity between a 3.3% population. Blacks are in jail at about 26%. So that's a huge difference. And why? So it's probably more than just the criminal aspects of what I'm trying to do. There's other issues with the courts, with judges, with sentencing judges, prosecutors. Why is this happening? Is it because of the area they live in? Is it, what are all the other reasons? So we do need to take a look at those. And so one of the bills I actually proposed that's not directly to drugs, but will directly get to this point, is a way to evaluate the risk level of a person prior to sentencing. And there are risk assessments. And we currently do risk assessments after sentencing. So you're going to jail. Judge has sentenced you to 5 years.
What do you mean by a risk assessment? What does that really mean?
Well, so we have – several states do this in the beginning processes of before you go to get sentenced for court. In Iowa, what we do is they do a risk assessment where they find a little bit about your background. They talk about your past history a little bit. They look at your family life and where you live and all these – there's a whole lot of things they look at.
And that influences your sentence?
Well, currently it doesn't. Because the judge does not currently get a look at any of that prior to sentencing. So after sentencing, currently, the judge is – he's done with you or she's done with you. You go to the prison. They do the risk assessment there, and then they try to do programming around that risk assessment. So if they see mm-hmm. mental health within the risk assessment, they get you mental health. They're trying to get you into mental health stuff. If they see just a drug abuse sort of thing, then they try to take the person through that. And the Department of Corrections right now has done a phenomenal job of using this risk assessment on release. So where they saw, and I think what they told us was Waterloo and Des Moines have the highest black arrest. And so when these folks are getting out of prison, they do this risk assessment too, and then they try to get them programming for when they get out. And their recidivism rate by doing this has dropped substantially. So we said, well, why are we doing this at the end? If it's working so well there, why don't we do it at the beginning and let judges see low-risk offender, not likely to do this again. What can we do in our communities to help them so that they don't come back to prison or they don't get arrested again? To me, if you do that at the beginning, you save a lot of time and money, and hopefully then we're treating our minorities better.
So if a judge had a risk assessment before sentencing, what would be the effect of that? It would affect his sentence, or what would it?
Yeah. So one of the things that right now what a judge can consider is only what the prosecutor puts forward and what the defense puts forward, and sometimes they agree, right? My client's going to plead guilty, and this is a joint recommendation. The judge then just has to sort of he gets to look at a few things, or she gets to look at a few things to make a determination, but then they make a determination of you're going to go to prison. Well, the risk assessment might say prison's not the right place for them, judge. A local place with mental health and drug abuse counseling and having a mentor for them or getting them back in school. The risk assessment might give more information to a judge to say, well, maybe even though you guys are recommending 2 years in jail, I'm going to say no, we're going to put them on probation and get them into these services. So that's my hope, and that's what they're doing at the back end sort of. So mm-hmm. why not give the judge the ability to do it at the front end? Mm-hmm.
So that's an additional piece of legislation that would make that change potentially.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and my hope is, and we got it through committee. It's we'll get it. It'll be debated on the floor, and hopefully we can get the House to take that up.
There's also been some reports in the news about, well, you mentioned recidivism. So the idea that it's difficult for people once they've been in prison to reintegrate into society. Are there legislative things that can be done to remedy that?
Well, anytime, and all the statistics show this, anytime a person goes to jail, even if it's for one day, their chance to recidivize goes up. So the longer we keep somebody in jail, especially for nonviolent crimes, these low-level crimes, they're more likely to recidivize. So, again, what I'm trying to do is let's not necessarily put them in jail for these nonviolent crimes right off the bat. Let's try to get them help so that they don't recidivize, because we know every day they go in that chance goes up that they're going to go out and do something else or come back to jail for another reason. Maybe it's for stealing next time. Maybe it's for – so how do we stop that at the front end? And so some of these things we're looking at I think will have some effect on that.
I think we didn't ask you really when you were talking about the initial legislation to give us kind of the status of where they are now.
Well, the 5 gram or less bill, we passed that on the floor of the Senate, and that was sent to the House. So anybody out there that wants to call their House member and push them, I would love that. And I really don't think you have any, at least in the Ames area, we're pretty good. We have great legislators over here that understand what I'm trying to do. So anybody out there listening, call your House member and tell them to help me push the bill through the House. The 42.5 gram bill, right now I'm one signature less than I need. So in both these committees, what I did was I put 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans on. And for the folks out there, when the Senate's in the majority is Democrats. So as a chair, I can put 2 Democrats, 1 Republican, 3 Democrats, 2 Republicans. That's typical. I actually did a 3-3. And so I need one signature from a Republican in the Senate to pass the 42.5 gram out, which I don't have yet. I'm hoping to get today. And then if we do that, it'll have a shot at the floor debate and then send over to the House as well. The medical marijuana and stuff, that's Senator Bochum's working on that. And I think he's hoping to get that out of full committee this week. And so that it's live round for the rest of the year.
Well, this has been great. I think we got a lot of clarity on a topic that may be confusing to people.
And if you've just tuned in, we're speaking with the Senator Steve Sodders, who recently sponsored several bills to change the way possession of small amounts of marijuana is dealt with in our legal system. And from what we hear, in general, you're looking to change a little bit the way the legal system is working to make it work out better in the long run for both the system and for the individual involved. Senator Sodders, you came in today from State Center, and you represent what area?
I have District 36 is the area I represent. It is all of Marshall County, all of Tama County, and I get a little piece of Blackhawk up by LaPorte City.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. We really appreciate it. And as I said, I think it's really clarified a bit of a confusing topic that people may have misconceptions about. So thank you very much for being here today. And
thanks for having me.
Talking with us. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Radio on 89.1 FM, Story City Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Thanks to Pat Schlarbaum for coming in to explain what we are hearing in the night in case we hear coyotes howling as they begin their mating season. And Jonas Michaels, the director of the Alternative Learning Programs for the Ames School District, was with us via a recorded interview. And a special thanks to the Honorable Senator Steve Sodders, who joined us to provide an update on some important bills that are before the state legislature.
Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison, and our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris, with a little help from the Coyotes today, from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music that you heard was the Academy Award-winning song Glory by John Legend and Common. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, so if you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. As always, your participation as the audience and your donations help make KHOI possible. You are what counts.
Your hosts for Local Talk today were Gail Seiler and Ursula Rudenberg. Remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of KHOI, and we'll see you again on the radio.